When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Morning, everyone. Hope you enjoyed the start of the Six Nations as much as we all did. We are all back on English soil, but due to the train strikes, I'm actually sat here in an empty studio looking up at a screen where I have one Charlie Morgan. Hi, Charlie.
Hello, Colsey.
And I've got one Charles Richardson. Hello, Charles.
Hello.
And they're joining myself, Ben Coles, to recap all the action from the opening round of the Six Nations. Where were you, gents? If I start with Charles, actually, where were you, Charles, this weekend?
I was in glorious Marseille on Friday night, you know, catching some rays, 60 degrees. It didn't feel particularly Six Nations-y, I must say. It's not what we're used to in the Six Nations. No gloves, no scarf, no Guinness. It was all very Provençal.
Sounds horrendous, actually, with the lack of Guinness. Did Marseille deliver on the atmosphere that we bigged it up a bit last week, didn't we? Was it as good as you hoped it would be?
Ish, yes, until, as we will come on to, the red card and the way that the game panned out meant that it didn't necessarily whip up the French crowd into a frenzy.
Mm. Charlie, where were you?
I was in Rome, which was decidedly, like, to follow on from Charles's point, it felt like a super Saturday in mid-March. It was gorgeous, cloudless, and I ticked off the bruschetta tiramisu and popped a game of rugby in right at the end. It was brilliant.
I'm glad you two have bigged up the weather, because Cardiff was absolutely atrocious. And I've never been happier than when I walked about 20 minutes from where I parked my car to the ground, and I got there and my coat was sopping. My glasses didn't have a spare sort of bit that wasn't covered in a raindrop. It was awful. So well done to everybody for agreeing that they should shut the roof. So that's good. We covered all three bases then. So we were all particularly well informed to chat about our respective games. So if we just, before we dive into talking about how England got on in Rome, I just wondered if you had a sort of favourite moment from the weekend that sort of stuck with you as you review how the last few days went. Charlie, if I start with you, what sort of leaps out?
It's Italy's second try. We'll get into kind of what a cluster of errors it was from England and sort of unfamiliarity with that defensive system that they've got. But the way Italy took it, gorgeous. Tommaso Allan finishing it off, but a lovely wrap between Paolo Galbisi and Brex in midfield just to make England look totally clueless. And that was where the atmosphere was at its kind of at its peak, and it kind of got more subdued from there. But that was just a brilliant moment.
Charles, how about you?
Well, I was going to say the same thing. So on the spot, I've thought of a secondary one, which has got to be that phenomenal Welsh second half resurgence, hasn't it? I know, I mean, it's a bit more, there's a lot of moments there, but I think just if you think back to the weekend that was, what will stand the test of time is okay, Wales won the game, lost the game, but they didn't win the game. But it felt at the end as if, bizarrely, they had. There was almost an element of Scotland are disappointed for banishing a 22-year hoodoo. So that entire crazy second half would be my moment of the week.
I was going to say that's an acceptable slip-up, because it did feel like it was an opposite situation. It felt like Wales had won and Scotland had lost. Also from that game for me was almost a surreal moment where it was chaos on the pitch, and I suddenly looked up at the big screen and they had a shot of Willem Dafoe, the actor, just sat there in a box watching the game, sort of being broadcast to the whole ground. And of all the people I expected to see on the big screen during that second half, he was not one of them. So that was very strange.
Do we know the link?
Absolutely no idea. As in nothing's kind of leaked out afterwards. No indication from any camp about why he was there, but it was, it was quite a surreal
moment. I can come in with a secondary one, actually.
Okay.
Given more time. Pasolo Twalangi debut, slightly not at the top of the list of priorities, but it was just nice to see him get on after all the chat, and he looked really good, if a little unfit, but when he was in and around the ball, he looked really special. And obviously Manu there in attendance watching, which was sweet.
I've growing up, I played against two Tuilagis, and I'm really glad I'll never, ever, ever have to get near him. What, he looked huge, didn't he?
It sounds really basic. He just looked so much bigger than so many other players on the field, just from sheer kind of stature. It was remarkable.
Who put their body? Somebody sort of roadblocked him off the first. They sent him off the top of a line out, didn't they? Somebody, and so it was a really good tackle. But
was it Crowley?
It looked terrifying. It might have been.
Yeah, it was a speed hump, sort of just lie there and just hope and pray.
Yeah, sometimes that's the best way. Well, listen, lots to talk about from those games. Let's start with how England got on with Rome. They won, which is a positive, but a few sort of things to address, I think. Okay, Charlie, it's the first game of a new cycle, so I know people might occasionally be a little bit impatient with England, but I think you sort of have to accept that, you know, this new system's bedding in. It's going to take a bit of time. Was that sort of how you felt afterwards? And did you feel more positive or negative about what you saw?
I was on the positive side, even sort of compared to the people around me. At half time, you sort of have a conflab, don't you, the people you're sitting near to. And everybody was a little bit more negative than I was. I went into it thinking, right, there's clearly going to be not only new systems here in a new defensive system and a new outlook on the way they attack, but also you factor in also the new faces, five debutants in the 23, and then also the sort of late disruption that they've had over the course of this 2 week preparation, which is short anyway, in key positions. So Alex Mitchell, we thought wasn't going to play because of an infection he had in his leg, but he was passed the late fitness test and was fit. But yeah, all things considered, considering also the cohesion of Italy and how settled they look, both in terms of personnel and the way they were going to play, I was impressed, actually.
There were a lot of questions from readers, sort of, I mean, it's very early to be wondering about whether these systems are going to work for England. And so I really would try and encourage everyone not to rush to too many judgments too quickly. But a lot of people just asking a fair enough question. Do they have the personnel to carry out this defensive system that Felix Jones wants to play, where it's significantly more aggressive than perhaps England have been used to in recent years?
I think it's a compromise. And I think it's a compromise, as we said from the beginning, of keeping those experienced players in and then maybe blooding others who are more suited to it. So, for example, I've been convinced from the minute that Steve Borthwick mentioned Manifeu Obosso in early January that he was more attractive a prospect because he suited what Felix Jones wanted, and he was playing that way for Exeter. And so you have that. That's one side, and then you want, obviously, the experience and how well Elliot Daly suits. He might not suit the system as well, but he offers experience. He offers that left boot on the left wing. Look at somewhere else like... So a theory, just kind of thinking out loud here, when I saw that question, was it was quite conspicuous, wasn't it, that Rafi Quirk was named as a player who was sort of going to join the squad despite not being fit. Who's he learnt from at Sales? He's sort of Faftekleurt Mark II, isn't he? Really kind of a small but super committed, super tenacious defender who'll be able to play that role of... pushing up and being that kind of spy out of the defensive line. So I think it's going to be a compromise. But I think what we'll see over the 4 years, and the compromise is that they want experience to kind of win those games and keep momentum over the 4 years. But the journey of 4 years is going to be getting a team that is suited to individual roles within these systems.
And even without sort of bringing in new personnel, I think there is an argument that they can do it anyway. That South Africa semi-final loss was probably England's, you know, best defensive performance of the past, well, God knows how many years. It was tenacious, it was aggressive, and it was everything that Steve Borthwick and Felix Jones want England to be without the ball. But now they have Felix Jones in their camp, and they've got sort of more time to embed this structure, and they've got more expertise too. And I think they proved that the foundations are there, the building blocks are there. I think, you know, George Martin coming back in when fit, depending on how long he can stay fit, is going to be big for them in that regard, because his defence is his super strength, really, and him coming back in will just continue this building. They got a couple of bits wrong in the first half, and it exposed them, and Italy are good enough to exploit it. But in the second half, when they sort of ironed out those creases, they defended excellently.
I had two thoughts on it, which was firstly that obviously it might take a little while and there might be a few glaring errors defensively from England, but it is a system that works because it has been the backbone of two Rugby World Cup wins. So stick with it. And the other one was Tommy Freeman's quotes afterwards, where he was sort of saying how for a player like him coming from Northampton's defensive system, obviously he was adapting to it a little bit more, and England had only had, I think they said, three training sessions really working on it in Spain, sort of as a group. So he was sort of suggesting for a player like him, it'll take time, whereas for players like Exeter, as Charlie's talked about with Faye Barbosa, they're used to kind of playing that aggressive blitzer out of the line to pressure people. And so I think it's just going to take a little bit of time. Speaking of Tommy Freeman, very impressive, helped create Elliot Daly's try. Charlie, he kind of had a roaming role, didn't he? And actually that helped create the extra man for Daly's try in the back line. What did you make of how he played?
Really impressive. It's funny, isn't it? Because there's this bridge between, between the Jones and Borthwick eras, and Jones brought him in and then sort of dropped him like a stone after that. Well, no, he didn't. Sorry. He brought him in, played in two games in the test series in Australia. He looked really good, and then he was injured for the start of the next autumn, and then played and was yanked at half time in what turned out to be Jones's final game. So he's come back after that. That was his first test appearance after that, and he looked so assured, and he looked like that time away has really helped him. Looks a bit bigger, if we're going to plug that piece on Northampton's bulk up again.
Haven't heard about actually, that. Tell us.
Actually, it's really interesting that you flag his quotes on the defence. I actually thought he looked really comfortable in that system. He's maybe the system is quite an advantage to be quite a small, nimble winger in that system, because you can change direction and you can sort of push off if the ball's gone beyond you. Look at someone like Colby and Kurt Lorenzo. They really so that agility is really important, but Freeman is kind of deceptively agile, as you saw from when he not only cut the line off Freddie Stewart to make the initial break, but then also went on that outside arc to free his arm to feed Daly for the offload. So yeah, I was really impressed by Freeman. Sorry, but and then again, it was kind of inevitable given how well he'd gone for Saints too.
Charles, just on Ethan Roots, that's a very good debut, isn't it? You come away with a nice player of the match medal, and you're winning plaudits and getting 9 out of 10s in player ratings, like he seemed to be. What was great about him?
Well, he just gave England something that they've been missing, and that they still continue to sort of lack it, really. But he's certainly made an impact in terms of the ball carrying stakes, and we've lamented the lack of English ball carriers on this podcast frequently, and it's telling that at number eight at the minute, and England's best player in the World Cup is basically an open side flanker who has been repurposed into a number eight, and ball carrying in the tight, not necessarily one of his strengths, with Ellis Genge missing as well. It looked all a bit sort of bit bleak on that front. But Will Stewart stepped up. The two second rows were outstanding. Ethan Roots was excellent in that regard. A very, very solid debut. I actually sort of would have lent more towards Tommy Freeman or Mario Itoje as man of the match, but I had no arguments with Roots at all. And I don't think many people were expecting that necessarily. His form has been good for Exeter, but I don't necessarily think that we were expecting him to have that impact on Test rugby so quickly. Maybe Charlie would disagree. Maybe he had it sort of predicted all along.
No, I wouldn't say I would. I think he suited as a foil for Earl, as you've kind of touched on there, as a foil for Earl. I think that really worked, because he's that big bopping blind side that England don't really have. I was really interested to see how quickly England brought him into the game. He took the first line out, didn't he? And he was really prominent in that regard, taking pressure off Chesham and Chessam Anatoji as that third jumper. He was a more natural third jumper than other options that have been there, and that allows Underhill and Earl to be sort of picked together too, doesn't it? So I didn't feel like he'd I was surprised maybe by just how influential he was, but that's a credit to sort of his personality as much as anything. But I was expecting him to be in the mix just because of how nice a foil he would have been for other guys around, and Steve Borthwick telegraphed his selection by picking him up so much as well.
Yeah, I mean, we knew he was a line-out option, didn't we, going into this? But I was also sort of taken aback by how regularly he was used and sort of how much of a source of good ball he was on that front, especially with Marrow and Chessam, who are both so adept in the air. I was surprised too.
It's quite satisfying when a player on debut performs so seamlessly like that. And we were getting whispers a few weeks back, weren't we, that he might be the solution at six when we were trying to work out how England would shape up in the back row. He was clearly a success. Part of me just wondered how this conversation would be going, because we all seemed quite positive how it would be going if England had lost. And I think that's a credit to how well Italy played. I know that late try kind of made the scoreboard look a bit tighter than it was. Charlie, I'm a bit bored of sort of getting excited about Italy and being hopeful and would like to see them actually string a few wins together. But did you see enough from them in this first game under Gonzalo Quesada to feel positive about the direction they're heading in?
I did, but I didn't agree with Jamie George saying that he wouldn't be surprised if they won two games this tournament. I would be surprised still if they won two games this tournament. And if you look at it, what they'd be targeting Scotland, the home game against Scotland, and then going to Wales. Still going to be a big kind of effort to do that. And they've traditionally started well when that cohesion of that big Benetton contingent helps them. Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. You still feel as though they'll be really disappointed, I think, with that second half, because they were subdued by a kind of an unfamiliar England defence, weren't they? Having cut them apart a couple of times in the first half, they'll feel like they didn't fire enough shots well enough in that second half. They'll be frustrated.
Well, and also arguably they should have been further ahead at half time. You know, they were the better side in the first half. I don't think many people would sort of disagree with that. But then they ended up going into that interval only 3 points ahead. And you look at it and you're going, okay, that's one of the best halves that Italy have had for a while, because they really struggled at the World Cup. And yet they're only leading by three at home against a New England side who were always going to have a few teething problems and were only going to get better. And so, yeah, they were stifled in the second half. But I did think England have been sort of craftily good at cutting this deficit and reducing the sort of scoreboard pressure on them.
And in terms of just thinking about England and looking ahead, if they're going to make any changes for the Wales game, would Ellis Genge potentially come back? Would he start, or would they stick with Joe Marler starting? How did that kind of look in terms of that front row, Charles? And could you see, are there any other changes that could potentially be made?
It's a tricky one, because I think obviously Ellis Genge is part of the leadership group and vice captain and clearly highly rated by Steve Borthwick. But if you start Ellis Genge, does that mean that Dan Cole has to start at tight head? Would you want Marler and Cole coming off the bench together, knowing what we know about their sort of, you know, they're excellent in the tight, but are there going to be when sort of teams are looking to be a little bit more expansive, is there a slight lack of mobility? And apologies to the two of them for suggesting this, but you know, they are aging props, really. Is a slight, with both of them on the field, are England a little bit sort of vulnerable defensively there, perhaps? So is it a case of, if Genge comes back in, you have to start Cole and then you bring Marler and Stewart on together? Perhaps. I mean, I think that in terms of the balance of the tight heads, there's an argument whereby Cole should start and play 50 minutes and Stewart should come off the bench anyway. So potentially he might look at that, starting Genge. In terms of other changes, did Dingwall do enough at 12? I mean, there aren't that many other options for next week, we don't think. Martin's going back in for rehab, so that suggests that he's not going to be fit. It wouldn't surprise me if he kept it unchanged, maybe with Genge and Cole, maybe swapping the props and then keeping it basically as you were. Did Underhill do enough at seven? There's a conversation there. I think there could be a rejig. I mean, Ben Earl could move back to seven if Martin was fit. They could use one of Chesham or Itoje at six and have Roots at eight. You know, there's options there, but I think the changes will be minimal.
Yeah, I wonder if they just stick with the same side for the first two games, get to the Fala week, then kind of reevaluate and consider what they want to do for Scotland. Charlie, just on Marcus Smith's injury, is there any sort of update from post-match about when he might be back?
He's been taken out of the squad for this week, so he won't be around. I don't think he's been definitively ruled out of the tournament yet. So they'll be, as sort of hinting at, following on there, sorry, from what Charles is saying, I think England can take it. And now they've got that first win since 2019 in the Six Nations, which is nuts. They can, you know, go all out for this week, and then they'll want to reevaluate ahead of the Calcutta Cup, and that week, extra week, will help them potentially with, if Martin's not back for this week, then certainly he'll be in the mix for Scotland, as will Ollie Lawrence, and then maybe Marcus Smith. We're still a little bit uncertain on that one.
Positive start then for England. Let's have a little break and then look at the rest of the games from the opening weekend.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Okay, we kicked off on Friday night in Marseille with, I would say, a bit of a surprise, but that's not to take anything away from Ireland. They were just exceptional. I just don't think we expected the margin of victory to be 21 points. That was extraordinary. Charles, was it a case of Ireland being brilliant and France being bad, or a bit of a combination? How do you sort of feel about it a couple of days later?
I think it was a sort of catastrophic occurrence of lots of tiny little things that sort of built up into that scoreline. Being completely frank, Ireland were good, but I wasn't quite as bowled over by them as other people were, which is scary in a way. And this is not to take anything away from them. It's scary because I think they've got more gears to go through. I thought France in that second half, admittedly down to 14 men, but they were really poor. And on the stroke of half time, they were poor. I do think the red card has maybe made more of a difference than people have maybe given credit for, because that was in a position where they were weak anyway. They're missing their two starting locks. Paul Valença was only really sort of fourth choice. They've drafted a 19-year-old, albeit a behemoth 19-year-old. They've drafted a 19-year-old onto the bench. And when Paul Valença was red carded, as he was the second time because it was upgraded, the line out went a bit to pot. But they were still in the hunt. You know, at 24-17, I was turning to colleagues in the press box, and we were sort of saying, there's still a game up. There's still a game on here, a real, real game. It didn't feel like Ireland were away until that first driving maul try. It was Sheehan who scored the first one, wasn't it? It was... And that was when you sort of felt, okay, it's done now. But France had chances, and just when Peter Omani had been yellow carded and France scored, you thought, hang on, there could be a real comeback on the cards here. And then there was a fabulous defensive read by James Lowe on Ramos, where he sort of almost showed Donty the inside, and Donty should have took it, but he passed behind to Ramos, and Lowe flew up, held him up, maul turnover, and at that point, you sort of felt like France, the momentum had shifted, and that was France's goose cooked, really.
such an interesting game for James Lowe, who were used to sort of dazzling us from an attacking standpoint. But you mentioned that bit of defence and also just how important his left boot was in the kicking game, Charlie, especially it felt like in the early exchanges where France just couldn't get any territory, and Lowe's kind of left boot and Gibson Park's box kicks were absolutely vital to sort of pinning France back and frustrating them.
The kicking game was fascinating from the very start, and I don't know whether it was a combination of factors, i.e. France's new halfbacks or them being seduced by the home crowd or them just wanting to shift how they were playing, but I thought they went away from what has been a fundamental part of their success. And Dupont's, it's not underrated because we talk about it loads, but Dupont's kicking, Luku absolutely smashed his first clearance up to halfway, but thereafter Ireland really exerted a lot of pressure on the ruck and made it messy for him. And France just fell away in those kicking exchanges. They tried to catch, there's a really interesting passage where Ireland got a little bit lucky. France tried to catch low over chasing. They had a line out and went wide, and then Ramos, I think it was, kicked back over Lowe's head, but Lowe saw it coming, readjusted, caught it, and then won the kicking exchanges with one that, you remember, it bubbled into the dead ball area and stayed still. And Ireland won that kicking exchange by comfortably sort of 40 odd meters, and they continued to do that throughout the game. And I think France ended up kicking 20 times in the game as a whole, which would be a lot lower than what they will have averaged last year. There'll be a lot of reasons for that, the fact that they went behind early and were down to 14 and they were chasing it anyway. But still, it's really interesting, and maybe they're going through some growing pains of their own, and Lowe's booming left boot sort of exacerbated them.
Did we see, Charles, the sort of effect of France bedding in a new attack coach and kind of how that might actually mean that they need a couple of games to actually get going? I know we've spoken about that with England, so it's only fair to say that France as well might need just a little bit of time to bed in with that system.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I think their attacking shape struggled, but also on top of that, there were just, I mean, I'm not really sure how much of a sort of a difference an attack coach is going to have on just fundamental basic errors. And you can obviously coach the rudimentary skills of the game. Of course you can, but these were sort of world-class players who were, you know, last season, you would never have imagined Donti and Fiku making sort of basic errors in both attack and defence, and yet they had crept in. And there is an element of chasing the game. There is a, clearly the red card had an impact, but it did feel a bit more pre-Galtier France. It really did have that sort of air about it of just, you know, that you don't know which French team is going to turn up. That old cliche that we thought had been dead and buried. Well, now it's sort of back that way. And no matter what happens at Murrayfield until the following week, you're still going to be able to say that, because either they're going to be a bit, you know, a bit mediocre again and Scotland are going to win, or I think they're probably going to go and absolutely blast Scotland off the park. It's one or the other, but it's that fickle, that sort of volatility of historical France that Galtier had worked so hard to vanquish and neutralise. That's rearing its head again.
I love that you're saying this a whole week after we got a question about that and you batted it away.
Like
you were swatting it for six in Hyderabad over the fence, and now it's back. It's back. It's a real question again. A rare 1.5 cards for Paul Willems. You touched on it earlier, and the contrast between France's depth at lock being tested and what happened with him getting those two kind of yellow cards in the first half hour with Joe McCarthy for Ireland, who was the form selection at lock. James Ryan was left on the bench, and so you had McCarthy and Ty Byrne. Charlie, just a word on how well McCarthy played. He was ripping up trees, wasn't he? Everything he seemed to carry was with wonderful intent, and he was superb.
Yeah, that looks like just about the only one of my predictions that's going to hold sway at the end of the tournament. The fact that he looks like the breakthrough player, doesn't he? He was breakthrough, statement performance, everything. He was just monstrous. Not just his carrying. I was watching this next to in a restaurant, actually, with a big screen next to our colleague Gav Mayers, and it was every time he'd just either pop out of the defensive line and pick someone up, quite literally. There was one on Francois Cross where Cross seemed to have won the collision initially, and McCarthy basically hauled him back 2 or 3 meters, or he'd smash into counter rucks and make poor Maxime Luku's life absolute hell. But that was a deserved man of the match, even though he came he came off towards the end, didn't he? And Tadhg Byrne, his lot partner, was phenomenal too. There were loads of excellent performances around that island pack. I thought McCarthy was the standout, and he's just a bit different. Like those heavy tight head locks are no wonder they're kind of earning the big bucks around the world. They are seriously valuable.
And we can't finish talking about Ireland without a word on Jack Crowley and just kind of how assured he looked. I wondered, Charles, just from watching it in the stands, whether you felt that he looked as good as he did because of the quality system around him, and it helps when you've got Bundiaki, just exceptionally high quality centre, cutting through over the gain line and making ground, and a scrum half in Gibson Park who can box kick it very far and has that kind of control. But equally, Crowley was impressive in his own right, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that, yeah, you're totally right. I mean, it's certainly helped by the fact that Ireland are so fluid and harmonious in terms of their attack. So we wondered how a new fly half would step up in that regard. And actually, of all the teams in the world, Ireland's probably the one where, as a new fledgling fly half, you'd probably quite like to come in because your pack's good. You're gonna be behind a solid pack. You might not get an armchair ride because there are other very, very good packs in the world, but you know you're gonna be behind a solid pack, and you know that in terms of attacking, everyone's on the same wavelength, and you've just got to slot into that. First 15 minutes, however, you were sort of wondering if he was the man, because there were a couple of errors. There was the charge down kick. There was the missed shot goal. I think there was another kick as well that went dead. And you were wondering, he looks nervy. He looks anxious. And I remember he was at 10 for Munster in that match that we've mentioned lots about fly halves, when Northampton went over there and won, and Finn Smith was outstanding. And he was similar there. He was a bit panicky, and then he just settled down and he just played beautifully. And that pass for the Tadhg Byrne try, I think that was the settler, the proper settler for him, where he'd made France look incredibly foolish on their own patch. This was pre the Willemse 1.5 card, pre the Willemse dismissal, if you like. And from there on, he just accelerated and he grew into it beautifully. He matured into the game. And by the end of it, it was a case of Johnny Who.
Some brilliant goal kicking as well. He drained a couple of touchline conversions, which weren't easy. And it's funny, wasn't it?
He missed the easy one.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, the straightforward one at the start where you were convinced he'd get it. And then he didn't get that, but he got some very difficult kicks from out wide. It was odd, wasn't it? It almost felt like it was his debut, even though obviously he had 9 test caps before then. It just felt because of the, I guess, Charlie, just because of the focus on him and how much expectation there is for him to fill Sexton's boots. And there were some very, very funny, very dry tweets going around from Irish fans on social media saying, like, oh, maybe it was Sexton who was holding us back all along, which I thought was quite funny.
Yeah, I mean, I was more impressed actually for him pushing through those tough moments that Charles mentioned. His ball for Byrne's try was really nice. And we said last week, didn't we, there's a bit of swagger about him, and he kind of had to call upon that, because I actually listened to the guys at the 42s sort of on the whistle podcast, and they said that it's almost a case for him of pulling that natural swagger back and almost playing within himself rather than sort of than going over the top of anything. I was really impressed, and more so for the strength of mind he had.
And just to put the absolute curse on Ireland now, Grand Slam again.
Someone's going to have to play really well to stop them, aren't they?
Obstacle. It looks like it's going to be over to England. You know, England are going to have to try and stop them because, I mean, okay, Scotland might be unbeaten. There's a chance that Scotland will be unbeaten when they go to Dublin, but we know Scotland do not enjoy playing Ireland, and this could be Ireland going for a Grand Slam at home. So it'd be a very, very brave man to put any kind of money on the Scots there, but we'll see.
Just imagine if we get Scotland going for a slam in Dublin on the Paddy's Day weekend. That would be fantastic, wouldn't it? I'd be all for it. Although I can see why you might not be trusting Scotland after what happened in Cardiff on Saturday, where for 50 minutes they were absolutely brilliant. Again, one of those where you wonder, were Scotland brilliant or were Wales utterly abysmal? And probably maybe actually in hindsight I'd lean slightly towards Wales being completely abysmal, given that Warren Gatland came out afterwards and spoke to S4C and actually apologised for the first half performance and said it was one of the worst that he's ever had in his coaching career. I think if that happens, then that kind of skews the balance a bit more towards Scotland being terrible. But having said that, to Wales being terrible, but having said that, Scotland, their precision of their kicking game with Finn Russell, the way they dominated all the breakdowns, the way that Wales attack just had nothing because the Scottish kind of defence was forcing turnovers or slowing down ruck ball. Gatland talked about Wales going into safety mode, which by that he essentially mean they go through three phases, get nowhere, hoover hopeless kick up field, which Scotland would then counter-attack from. I was really, really impressed with Scotland and writing this very praise-heavy piece about how they'd finally sort of shaken off this tag of being chokers and how impressive was this performance. And then Wales started coming back and it all went to chaos. And then Willem Dafoe appeared on the big screen. It was an extraordinary second half. I don't know how much either of you managed to actually see of it. Charles, you might have seen more. It's funny, momentum's a fascinating thing, isn't it? And when Wales was sort of getting two tries and then three tries, it did feel as though they were going to win, didn't it? Just the way the second half was panning out.
Yeah, and I mean, as I say, it almost still feels like they did, and yet they didn't. But I mean, what was the atmosphere? I mean, I've spoken to people who were there, and they said that the atmosphere was absolutely sensational in the Principality Stadium during that second half, the best that they've experienced for a number of years.
I'd go with it. Having covered quite a few games there, absolutely deafening. Got to the point where it was deafening when the tries were scored, but every kind of catch made by Aaron Wainwright when he then set off on a run and would beat defenders, you thought a try had been scored. It was so loud. I have always thought that it is the best rugby venue, particularly with the roof closed, and days like that do reinforce it. And maybe it was because of that noise and momentum that you felt Wales were going to do it. So I know Scotland nearly blew the biggest lead in Six Nations history. I think it was going to be the biggest comeback. Credit to them for kind of regathering themselves in the final 10 minutes. The two yellow cards throughout the second half admittedly didn't help, and they lost momentum massively in those stages. But I think psychologically, to have not, and it's not just about winning in Cardiff for the first time in 22 years, I think actually just to win that game, given it was about to fall through their fingers, that impressed me. And I know that sounds odd given they were in such a position of strength, but if they can take the lessons from that, iron out a few things. Charlie, I don't know. I wonder if actually this might be a team that we can start taking a bit more seriously. And I think that would be great for the championship.
It was wild though, wasn't it? Like, yeah. It was absolutely wild. I know we were talking about how Scotland, we know, kind of want to do three things in this championships. One is be more disruptive and aggressive with their defence. Two is be more adaptable with their attack. And they also want to be able to seize control of moments and not let them slide. But that was a pretty poor start on that front, wasn't it? It reminded me, it was the reverse of the mad Calcutta Cup game in 2019, when it was Scotland making that amazing comeback. And then going ahead and then Ben Teo going under the post and it being a draw. But there'll be frustration and there'll be, in a way, they're almost back to square one, whereby they know that they've got the talent to cut teams apart and almost toy with teams, and they can look like a really balanced side. Equally, they can totally capitulate. And I don't know how much history was wearing heavy on them, but what's interesting is that they have now ticked off another sort of, burden for them. And over the last couple of years, they've ticked off a few burdens against France, you know, beating them twice. And they have traditionally sort of matched up quite nicely against France. But last year in Paris, it was another patch, albeit at the beginning of the game, when they went 19-0 down, I think, that kind of stopped them in their tracks and gave them a mountain to climb. So, yeah, fascinating. I feel like I'm back to square one, having looked, as you say, Ben, really high on them and then just seeing that they're still, it's quite jarring that they're still capable of something like that. And we should mention the penalty count. They were, Ben O'Keefe just hated them for a bit, didn't he?
The penalty count's absolutely hilarious. So it finished 16-4, I think. And Scotland at one point had conceded 14 penalties in a row. That's got to be close to a record, Charles, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we at now, you never know which Scotland are going to turn up. That's almost what we're at now. But I think, a crazy, crazy game with a very underwhelming sort of finish and a very anticlimactic ending. And I think if we're being killjoys, which, you know, we try not to be, but I think if we're being really sort of realistic, Scotland really should have won that game by a little bit more, and that try at the end, I mean, they were stopped by it. Do have Van der Merwe put the ball on an ankle rather than the line, and they did actually score at the end, and that would have been a bonus point for them that might prove critical. And so they did well to get over the finish line in the end, but I think that sort of try at the end, the sort of almost clumsiness of it, summed up their evening.
Part of me wondered if they were just relieved to be in the area of the field where they were, because they got a penalty advantage, I think, from the scrum or breakdown. I can't remember what it was. And almost it was the fact that they were just short of Wales line. There was kind of widespread relief that they knew they probably weren't going to lose it from there. Finn Russell was really interesting afterwards. He had some quotes to the BBC, which I'm just going to read. He was Scotland captain in that game. And he said... The frustrating thing is the points that I was making to his teammates just weren't being listened to. I told them to leave the ruck and they still kept going in at the ruck, and we get a yellow card for going in too many times and for offside. So it was almost him kind of being like quite uniquely for a captain and essentially a new captain, because it's only his second game as captain after one warm-up last summer, and now he's a co-captain alongside Rory Darge. I found it quite interesting how he was saying, you know, like, pay attention to me. Like, I need to be listened to. I'm trying to help you here. We also had a little clip of him afterwards, because he had a very good goal kicking performance, and that ended up being quite pivotal for the final score. He spoke afterwards about how he found it quite easy playing inside under the roof.
Yeah, we're indoors, so it's nice and easy. Need to have a chat with the guys at SIU and get a roof over there. My kicking was good. I've been feeling good the last week, so that was pleasing for me to hit, I think it was 5 from 5 or something like that, which I suppose effectively proved the point in the end. But I think personally for me that was nice. But the boys scored 2 tries under the post, which makes it a little bit easier as well.
Something tells me the Scottish Rugby Union are not going to be investing in a roof anytime soon for Murrayfield, but it's a nice idea, isn't it? I just wondered whether, just thinking ahead about Scotland-France, Charles, you've talked about not knowing which France are going to turn up and not knowing which Scotland are going to turn up. So if I've forced you to give me an answer about who was going to win, given that Scotland are going to be at home and France looked a bit out of sorts in Marseille, which way would you lean?
I think I'm going to lean with French backlash. That might be heart overhead slightly, but I'm going to go French backlash, France to win at Murrayfield, and I can't see it being perfect from them, but I think they will have enough. I think they will have enough, and you can't see the sort of things that were happening in the second half last weekend happening en masse so sort of dramatically again. I mean, or can you? Can you? You might be able to. I don't know. I'm talking myself out of it even as I'm speaking.
I mean, my top tip for France would be to maul everything if they can, because Scotland's maul defence, Gregor Townsend noted afterwards, has actually been a strength of theirs in recent years, but completely went to pot in Cardiff. They just didn't have an answer, and to concede three driving maul tries will really frustrate them in the week. And so, Charlie, is that an obvious area for France to kind of target them, I guess?
It is, but they'll have type 5 injuries and unavailability of their own, right? France with Valenza likely to miss. The Valenza thing was so disappointing because he's been so pivotal to them. So will Tuilagi start, Charles?
Yeah, I was wondering this. Is he fit enough? I don't think he is. I don't think he's fit enough to go beyond. I think the plan all along would have been to unleash him off the bench for the last maybe 10 minutes, 5 minutes in different circumstances. Obviously, the way that the game panned out meant that they felt that they needed a bit more dynamism and a bit more sort of an impact earlier on. I was wondering what they would do here, because then if you start Wokey and Gabriag together, you're quite lightweight there. Admittedly, they're both excellent players, but the line-out struggled, so there might be a temptation to bring Wokey in. But saying that, you know, their entire back row are line out forward, so it shouldn't be struggling, really. They might be tempted to bring Twangy in. I don't think Mayafu's fit for this weekend. I think he's missing the first two games. There might be a temptation, but I'm not sure he's there yet, whereby he could be starting a test in the Six Nations. But he would cause some damage. He would really cause some damage if he did start. It's just more... And it was his jackling. I was impressed by his jackling. It was more that towards the end of the game, the ball was going into touch and he was absolutely miles away from it. And you could see, being in the stadium, him having to jog basically the entire width of the pitch to get to this line out. Let's just say he wasn't necessarily hurrying.
And against Scotland, who are going to... you know, spread you from edge to edge, that's right. Potentially pretty problematic. I couldn't call it at all. I think for the sounds really sanctimonious, doesn't it, but for the good of the tournament, a Scotland win and Scotland getting on a roll so that they can both them and Ireland can be unbeaten on that final weekend would be delicious, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
I was just having a quick scan of Tuilagi's minutes for Perpignan, and they're all over the shop, actually, this season. He's sort of had spurts of 50 or 40 or 30. He's done 80 minutes twice all season. So I think, and Test Rugby's obviously significantly a step up as well. So that might be a bit of an ask for him. Like you say, Charlie, I'm kind of siding with you. I love this idea of Scotland going to Dublin at the end and having all that momentum. And if you beat France, then what is it? You've got to face England, kind of a Wales who are, oh no, faced Wales already, got to face England and then Italy and Rome. Yeah, it could happen. I'm not ruling it out at all. Just before we get to your questions, we wanted to comment on the death of Barry John on Sunday, which was announced Sunday afternoon. Very sad, and another great of Welsh rugby, known as the King, and when you get that nickname, then that's always pretty special. Charlie, I know with a lot of sort of Welsh ancestry, it's part of your family. He was one of the greats, wasn't he? And he will be certainly missed.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my father's favourite players, slight even for the amateur era, but just a ghosting, gliding playmaker who seemed to bend games to his will. And it was really interesting sort of writing up the news story last night, just reading some of the tributes sort of at the time that his peers would give him. So Gareth Edwards, here the famous sort of exchange, you pass it, I'll catch it, which is what Barry John said to Gareth Edwards when they first met. But Gareth Edwards later wrote that he had a cool superiority which spread to others in the side, remarkable marvelous easiness in the mind, reducing problems to their simplest form, backing his own talent all the time. I just thought that was really cool. And actually watching, you know, it's very limited footage and very grainy footage that we see of those games in the late 60s and 70s, but that comes across, doesn't it?
Yeah, those sort of legends, that golden era, that Welsh golden era, they're sort of leaving us one by one, aren't they? It's all quite sad. Yeah, Barry John, the Red Phantom, Bill McLaren used to call him, rugby's first superstar, and then, you know, he became that sort of icon of rugby, and the, you know, it transcended the sport, and then obviously turned his back on it all. And yeah, I mean, it, just in terms of our coverage of it, it's difficult for us, I suppose, to add anything above and beyond what Cyrene McGeachan has written. Obviously, Cyrene McGeachan played in that era, and his tribute, just like his JPR Williams tribute, is very touching. And I'd sort of encourage all listeners to try and scout it out and give it a read.
Charlie, I think you used the word gliding to sum him up, and that's perfect from watching the coverage. He had fantastic kind of footwork and running lines, and was, you can see why he was so popular after that tour to New Zealand, and also why I think the story around him retiring at 27 is fascinating, about how he sort of turned his back on the limelight and the media of it all. And his line about describing Wales as a bit of a goldfish bowl is one that's been used often by players and coaches sort of moving forward. But a fantastic legacy, a player who I know is revered by many and who will be deeply missed. Okay, let's have some of your questions. Thank you for sending in so many when we sent them out on Sunday. Plenty to get through, and we'll try and go over a few things we haven't covered so far. Just starting with a question from Andrew, who says, kind of apart from Ireland, is there really a lot separating the rest of the teams? And could it be very competitive from positions 2 to 6? Charles, what do you make of that? It does feel as though, based on Friday night alone, that they are a little bit ahead of the rest, Ireland.
Yeah, and the competitiveness of positions 2 to 6 is certainly a narrative that has been built this weekend with how narrow the scorelines were both in Rome and in Cardiff. Before quite going down that road, I would like to see another round of fixtures, just because there is the chance that England could beat Wales quite comfortably. There's also the chance that France could beat Scotland quite comfortably. And then you're sort of, you know, and you know, Ireland have probably got a loss in them at some point, maybe if it's not this tournament, at some point. And then you might be looking at sort of a closing of the gap to Ireland from what we thought on the first weekend and the opening weekend, where, yes, they clearly look like the outstanding team in the championship and the outstanding candidates for a Grand Slam and for a championship title. But I think a few of the other teams are going to have a little bit... they're going to have something to say about that, let's say. And, I mean, is there a chance that second half from Wales has flattered them a little bit? We won't know until this weekend. I think they're a true test of what the true Wales is of those sort of two completely polar opposite halves will come at Twickenham this weekend.
It's an interesting kind of subplot to that question, isn't it? Because we've almost written England and Wales off in advance, because it just seems like there's too many new faces, too many new systems, or too many new systems being bedded in, and therefore can you turn it all around in time to win? But I don't know. The more I wonder about them, if they can get a couple of wins and be in a position, if one of them can be in a position but where they've got a couple of wins by round 3 or 4, maybe not for Wales, certainly for England. I'm intrigued, put it that way. A question we had from Jared was, is Wainwright potentially the best number 8 in the Six Nations, if not the best? I think, I mean, immediately... He was very good in the second half, particularly. Like he carried like a bolting horse, I think I put in my match report, because he just seemed to make so much ground. But when you consider the candidates for number 8 with Caelan Doris and Gregory Aldrett and what Bennell's done for England, Charlie, would Wainwright be second best? I'm not so sure personally.
I say this as someone that really, really rates Wainwright. I remember there was a moment. He took the ball in the backfield. I think it was like a bobbling ball. Looked up again in a game against the All Blacks. Saw Rico Ioane and burned Rico Ioane. And he's just a phenomenal athlete, great player. So I say this with that in mind. I think Caelan Doris and Gregory Aldrett, I think there's daylight behind those two. Then I think he'd be in a mix of players. I really rate Mac Ferguson as well, and Lorenzo Canoni's a good player, who's one of Italy's best, along with Menoncello at the weekend. And then we haven't mentioned Ben Earl at all, who was England's best player at the World Cup. So I'd say, how about diplomatically, we say that he's part of a chasing pack behind Doris and Aldrett, who are probably the class acts.
It's a crowded field.
That's very polite.
That's my politician's answer.
That's very
crowded
polite.
Field of bolting horses.
Bolting horses. The only thing I would say about Wainwright, also it's very hard to say Aaron Wainwright 5 times in a row, I've just realised, is that kind of under Gatland he was a favourite, and then under Pivak he sort of went to the fringes of selection because he wasn't what he was looking for, and then as soon as Gatland returned last year he was straight back in, and he's been kind of an ever-present ever since. He's clearly someone that Warren really rates highly for what he offers in terms of athleticism with improving physicality. But yeah, like Charles says, it's a busy group. Question from Paul Tate is, do Italy finally have the right coach now? I mean, it's one game in a cycle, and I think we were huge fans of Kieran Crowley during his time there and what he managed to achieve, and also his subsequent input on the Netflix series. Charles seems to have gone down quite well, given his honesty. But what do you reckon? Is Quesada potentially, you know, a good step forward?
Yes, but I don't think Crowley had done much wrong, in all honesty. I think the World Cup was a bit of a disaster for them.
That's it, isn't it? I think it's the way the defence just imploded at the World Cup and shipping 96 points to the All Blacks.
But, I mean, the announcement around him, his departure, surprised him, and he didn't want to go, and that happened pre-World Cup, and you don't know what sort of an effect that had. But I think he brought them on a lot, and really, it's Quesada's job to sort of build on that, on really good foundations. They have a really sort of lethal set of attacking rugby players in their starting 15. The depth is where they struggle. But then it's just all about set piece and defence, and the nuts and bolts of Italy's game is where the improvements are needed. Is Quesada that man? I mean, he's got great top 14 experience in France with both Racing and Stade. It's just difficult to judge after one game, being honest. You hope that he's the right man. You hope that they've got the right coach. The signs are, you're optimistic that it's the case, but we'll have to see how they go over the next four matches.
I really like that question, because I totally agree with everything Charles has said there. I think you've just got to think about the succession, really, and what Crowley has given them. It is something that can be their kind of USP as a side. And now it'll be up to Quesada to sort of, as Charles said, solidify the foundations that USP can work from, even.
Yeah, I think that's all very fair. We had a question from William Fisher asking, was Willem Dafoe at the Principality part of a fever dream? I mean, it was certainly my favourite moment. I just wondered if we're thinking about England, Wales and Scotland, France, who's going to pop up on the big screen that's going to make you do a double take and think, is that really who I think it is on the big screen? I'm thinking like Tom Cruise at Twickenham, for example, might be one where that might throw you off your game a little bit. Are there any that spring to mind that would catch you by surprise?
Margot Robbie?
Yeah.
I mean, she used to be a Clapham resident, so I don't think that's certainly out of the question. She knows
there'll be a few Clapham residents at Twickenham, you'd imagine.
That's true. That's true. Charles, anybody? Anybody at Murrayfield who you might think, blimey, what are you doing there?
No, not after Willem Dafoe. Is there anybody? Well, just no. No, is that going to be beaten? Because he's a Hollywood A-lister, but also quite rogue and niche. So is there anybody like, he's in a very sort of niche of his own in that regard. No, I can't think of anybody off the top of my head.
Final question from James Chandler about what makes the perfect breakfast. Did you do a video of your breakfast at your hotel? Like you promised Twitter followers?
It was for my wife, but it ended up being, for a lot more people, I think. Yeah, the answer to that question is cake when you're in continental Europe, and when you're home, it's black pudding.
Ooh. I can't disagree with black pudding, but I think eggs have always got to be somewhere in the melting pot.
You sent us a video of some gelato, but I wasn't sure about what time of day that was, whether that was post-game or pre-game, or is that just all times of day for your prep?
It's all times of day. That particular video was post game. Yeah, my walk back to the hotel to watch the game back like a true pro.
Okay, that's it for today, guys. Where are you going to be this week, Charlie? Where are you going to be?
Going to be Twickenham at the weekend and cutting back and forth from Pennyhill Park, by the sounds of it, over the week.
Have you missed Pennyhill and its leafy surroundings and its good spread of refreshments for journalists?
Yeah, absolutely. Refreshments for journalists always.
Charles, where are you going to be?
I am following Wales this week in Twickenham, flying to Cardiff, and then I'm at England Wales at Twickenham also on Saturday.
Lovely. I will be at Murrayfield for Scotland against France. The which version of which team will turn up game, as Charles has billed it. Very excited to see who does. Thank you to Charlie. Thank you to Charles. Thanks to you for downloading the podcast. If you're new, welcome along. If you're an existing person who's passed it on to your friends and family, thank you very much for doing that as well. Don't miss out on all our...
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Coverage on the Six Nations. There's loads coming out over the next few days and plenty more as we build up to another exciting weekend. But that is all for this week. So enjoy the games. We'll catch you next week. Goodbye.